from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The summer solstice is almost here, June 21st, the year's longest day. But on the other side of that day, there's the warm, welcoming embrace of summer nights. When the sun sinks below the horizon, the shadows grow long, and the magic creeps in with the evening. Even now, with our 24/7 lives, our houses and cities pulsing with electric light, that first touch of night can take us back to a time before the light bulb, to a time before we could banish the darkness with the flip of a switch. Then, night was another world, the realm of thieves and sinners, spirits and secret loves. It was truly dark, impenetrable, dangerous, yet inviting. Humanity was tied to the moon and stars as much as to the sun and light. And when darkness came at the close of day, so did a distinct human culture. Our guest tonight spent over 20 years studying the history of that dark half, the forgotten half, he says, of the human experience. Tonight on Point, we'll turn back the clocks, turn out the lights, and plunge into the forgotten history of the night. Joining me now from Roanoke Mountain, Virginia, is Robert Ekirch, award-winning historian and professor of history at Virginia Tech. His new book is At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. Richard Ekirch, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, and I just love this long, lazy, in-depth. I don't mean not industrious. You've pulled everything up here, but this long look at night is such a pleasure. Night may have been banished by electric lights, but opening the pages of this book, and we're very deep, deep into it. You've been in it for 20 years. It's a long time.
A very long time, but I can honestly say that up until the last 6 months, when I was faced with the tedium of proofreading and those sorts of things, it truly held my fascination. I thought at the outset that it would be a rich topic and hoped that others might share my interest in it.
As I dipped in and began to feel the allure of this, I guess I realized maybe this is what you were responding to, a kind of night deficit in myself these days. It must be shared by a lot of humans. If the history you're telling here, just as the history you're telling here suggests, I mean, a kind of deficit of that darkness and time to interact with it directly that you describe here going on for centuries and centuries, clearly, before light came. I felt almost a kind of need to read about this and relive it, even if we don't have this kind of night.
Well, we're definitely on a trajectory, I think, toward truly a 24/7 world. Increasingly, I fear, rather than render nighttime more accessible, we're instead beginning to risk its gradual elimination. I think already, certainly astronomers feel this way. The heavens, an age-old source of awe and wonder, have been obscured by the glare of outdoor lighting, especially in urban areas. And really only in remote spots can one still glimpse the grandeur of the Milky Way. Entire constellations have disappeared from sight, replaced, for all intents and purposes, by a blank sky. You may recall the Russian government has even attempted, I think about 10 years ago, to launch an experimental space mirror designed to transform night into twilight in selected locations with the aid of reflected light from the sun, which aroused quite a storm of opposition in Canada, I remember. It was received a lot of publicity in the Canadian press because they would have been at least partial beneficiaries, as the Russians saw it, of the reflected light.
We should begin to take us back, Roger Ekirch, to that time before such wide illumination in the evening, essentially before electricity, and help us begin to wade into how humans thought about, experienced, looked at the night before it was so lit up.
I found that nighttime really posed something of a paradox in the pre-industrial age. We're talking roughly the period from the late Middle Ages to the Industrial Revolution. On the one hand, clearly it was a time of great danger. Rarely did pre-industrial folk pause to ponder the beauty of a sunset like we might today. Instead, all sorts of threats to body and soul expanded, intensified after dark. I make the argument, and I think it's well supported, that probably never before in Western history, at least since the birth of Christ, had evening, for a variety of reasons, some real, some imaginary, appeared more menacing.
Why so particularly menacing at that time? Why more menacing then than in the Middle Ages or the ancient period? What is it about what you call the early modern period that made nighttime threatening?
Two reasons in particular. Crime, pretty much, which was widely feared to be sure, remained fairly constant in people's perceptions. There were fluctuations. But what did rise appreciably beginning in the late Middle Ages was the fear of fire. Arguably, as one historian has pointed out, fire, along with plague, aroused the greatest dread during this period of time. And unlike the plague, fire struck without any warning. It was a persistent threat after dark, especially in this age, because now more than ever people resided, at least in cities, in tightly packed neighborhoods where wood and thatch still dominated construction. The second fear that escalated greatly was that of supernatural beings, evil demons and spirits, including first and foremost the so-called Prince of Darkness himself, who began, for all sorts of reasons, cultural, intellectual, religious, began definitely to assume a more menacing persona by the early modern era. It's not coincidental that this, after all, was the era of the ferocious witch craze in which literally thousands of individuals were put to death across Europe and to a lesser degree in early America because they were suspected of being witches and, in many cases, agents of the devil himself.
What's your interpretation of what was stirring in that early modern era that made people peer into the dark and see it so extraordinarily fearfully?
There were a variety of reasons, certainly to explain the escalating fear of supernatural beings. Some were peculiar to particular parts of Europe. Some, however, were fairly widespread. Certainly this was an age of immense pessimism. Plague, starvation, endemic warfare, all of which put European society very much on edge. People, at least in part, to help explain what was happening around them, for which there was no obvious explanation, many of them immediately thought in terms of supernatural forces and the devil and his agents in particular.
But on the other side of that fear, you describe night as a time fundamentally, in your words, of liberation and renewal. That seems the opposite side of the coin.
Mm. Therein the paradox lies, because in addition to being a time of great fear, it was also a very vibrant period of time. A hell of a lot went on after dark that historians in the past have simply ignored. Many believing, as I once did, that people simply retired with the setting sun and slept blissfully throughout the darkness. The answer to the paradox lies in two reasons, I think. one simply being that over a long period of time, individuals had perfected a number of techniques, conventions, rituals that they relied upon to navigate the darkness, both at home and, as they commonly put it, abroad, the term they used for going outside, to navigate the darkness in relative safety. I mean, truly ingenious techniques, notching stair rails, for example, for when one had to turn and going from one level of a house to another. There are any number of conventions and that people relied upon along those lines. Equally important in terms of explaining why this was such a vibrant time was Knight's appeal, as you've suggested, for large portions of the population.
Portions Knight, before the lights came on, before the Industrial Revolution. Roger Eakerch, please stand by. We're going to take a short break here. Come right back. Roger Eakerch's new book is At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. You can join the conversation tonight. What is nighttime to you today? Do you feel it as its own province? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the night and what it meant to humanity, how it was lived before electricity and all the lights that banish the darkness today. It was a different world. My guest tonight is Roger Eakerch. He's author of the new book, terrific book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. You can join the conversation tonight as well. Can you imagine life, night, when it really got dark, when the sun went down? Have you ever spent even 1 week without a light switch, without a gas lamp? What's the quality of that kind of night? And what is nighttime to you today? Does it feel like its own province? Do you let yourself sink into the nightness of night? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Roger Eakerch, I was struck in the book at how differently night was simply organized, I guess you might say, in the house and outside the house in the time before nighttime illumination was so common. I wish you'd take us into some of that. In the domestic scene and in the public setting, how night was organized, approached, even patrolled.
For agencies of church and state, the less activity at night on public streets, in public squares, the better, as they saw it. Night, from their point of view, was meant for rest and prayer. They resorted, officials, to a variety of repressive measures, from curfews to watchmen to curb nocturnal activity. Fewer persons abroad, the better, as they saw it. Toward that end, they closed town gates. There were curfews, streets shut down with massive iron chains. But remarkably, these curfews and other repressive steps ultimately had little effect, and people instead were far from powerless in dealing with the night. As I was saying earlier, they relied upon any number of techniques. They wore white clothing. They piled mounds of sandy or chalky soil where it existed. In southern England, these were known as down lanterns. They blazed trees, and they relied much more heavily upon their secondary senses. There was a Scottish saying, "The day has eyes, the night has ears," so that all sorts of familiar noises, especially barking dogs, interestingly enough,
sure,
afforded travelers outside welcome wayposts, as did bakeries, honeysuckle bushes. Smell was nearly as important as one's sense of hearing.
For navigating in the true dark, what about inside the home, in the domestic setting? I mean, today, sunset comes, dusk comes, the lights go on, life goes on. What was the rhythm of life when the illumination would be a candle, a fire? Compare just sort of the use of the, you know, of the span of the clock in those days, how people lived it to how we live now.
Sure. Reference to hours as we know them today, set intervals of time, those references were becoming increasingly more widespread during this era. But for the most part, especially for ordinary men and women, they instead had a very different way to calibrate time. They did it in part according to nature and according to basic human activities. The arrival of nightfall itself was widely referred to as shutting in, a time to bolt doors, close shutters, and set loose one's watchdog, if you had one, as most people actually did. After shutting in, after nightfall itself, the next principal interval or demarcation of time was candle lighting, when it became literally too dark to perform any labor or cook or much of anything. And there certainly was a variety of sources of artificial lighting during this period, ranging from candles to what were called rush lights, which were reeds soaked in bacon fat or some other source of tallow. Oil lamps were widely used throughout continental Europe. On the other hand, certainly, for the better part of an evening, even within one's home, except perhaps for the hearth of a fire and perhaps a single candle or a rushlight, people were, in fact, forced to navigate the darkness within their own dwellings. And toward that end, they met a mental map of the internal topography of their homes from an early age. Virtually everyone knew how many steps existed in a given flight of stairs. Scandinavians at night routinely, before they went to bed, in case they had to get up in the middle of the night, they pushed furniture against the walls of their rooms so that they would not hurt themselves or, for that matter, the furniture.
And you write that laws themselves were tailored around night and what it meant. In some Swedish cities, robbery committed after curfew warranted the death penalty. In many European jurisdictions, killing a housebreaker was legal if the crime occurred at night, but not after sunrise. I mean, night had its fears and its special laws and rules.
Yes, it did. For all intents and purposes, civil courts, civil law itself, shut down at the end of day, whereas criminal law, criminal prosecutions, and in some cases criminal courts themselves became even more active and decidedly more harsh. Juries in convicting any criminal defendant would be informed whether the deed had been committed at night or not, and the punishment would frequently be more severe if it had been. There were in some Italian cities special courts that operated with greater latitude at night. Torture, where it was ordinarily permitted in some European nations, more leeway was given to torturing an individual if he or she were apprehended at night. And whereas slaying whether by sword or by musket, a potential burglar inside one's house was thought legal, an act of self-defense. During the day, it was considered an act of homicide. The difference being, as prosecutors typically put it, that during the day, one presumably could conclude whether the intruder had simply burglary, theft in mind, or instead something more diabolical.
Whereas at night, you
didn't have that.
You didn't have that, and so a different attitude from the court. Roger Ekirch, a lot of callers want to join us. We want to begin to invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Roger. It's good to be on your show.
Great to have you. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to say that I probably speak for several thousand of returned Peace Corps volunteers in that many of us have experienced the night without electricity, and it's a beautiful thing. And it's a time to sit around and talk with one another, and not necessarily to be fearful, but really you can't do a whole lot else except be together with other people.
Where did you see that kind of night, Eric?
In Mauritania.
Ah.
In West Africa. So
yeah.
It's a different context than the European history that we're hearing about on the show. But what I found interesting is that while it was a very beautiful time for me, and I felt very safe at night there, and there's a lot of starlight and moonlight to see by, there's still residue from 30 years ago before all the lions and hyenas and snakes were pretty much killed off there, where people are still pretty afraid to walk around at night, Mauritanians themselves, whereas I felt perfectly safe. Maybe it's because I'm from America, where we can walk around at night and there's not a lot to be afraid of.
A kind of a habit on your part, maybe naivete on your part.
Yeah, probably to some degree. There were still some snakes, but they're very few and far between.
But a kind of respect there among the local people for what night could mean. Eric, thanks for that vision. I mean, Roger Ekirch, it reminds us that even today you see the photographs taken of Earth from space that show where light is concentrated, and there is a lot of it, but there are still very dark expanses on the planet today that where electricity is not the order of the evening.
In North Korea, for one, as opposed to South Korea, which is quite striking if you look at one of those satellite images. I mean, it really conveys very powerfully how much more industrialized South Korea is than its northern neighbor.
Francie is calling from Boston. Hi, Francie, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you to the gentleman for writing the book. Myself, coming from a different country, I'm from Haiti.
Yeah.
I can tell you that experiencing, you know, the night, you know, with no light, no gas, nothing like that, leaving the capital to go outside the city itself, when you're experiencing the night, the dark, it's so beautiful. It can be peaceful at the same time. You know, it's just like you have a chance to catch up with your friends by sitting in the dark, having a conversation and things like that. I think there's a peaceful side of it that, you know, other people might not have a chance to experience.
And what about your dream life or imagination life, Francie? Do you associate that more with real darkness than with the kind of illuminated night we have here?
You know, I mean, it's depend, though. It's depend, I would say. You know, my dream life, you know, I mean, even here in the United States, I would turn off the lights in my house, and I would just lay it in my bed. It's just like, just to take me back home. Like when I'm thinking so deep, you know, I will turn off the light, and the light, you know, by being in the darkness sometimes can help you think so deep to go to places where sometimes you don't know you can be.
Ooh, it's wonderful, Francie, and we thank you for sharing that. Roger Ekirch, you write that by turning night into day, modern technology has helped obstruct our oldest path to the human psyche. Here's a reference to that, brought to us from Haiti in memory.
That was a terrific observation.
Really terrific.
That she made.
But your sense, your historical research shows us what about how the human psyche was opened up in night, when night was really dark?
First of all, people attach great importance to their dreams. 300, 400, 500 years ago, there were entire compendiums of dreams that were published. They were bestsellers of the day, in which one could interpret one's night visions, according to so-called experts on the subject. Dreams routinely were repeated to one's family members. They were repeated in letters, written in diaries. Sometimes they would change the course of a person's day, or more rarely, an entire lifetime. John Rolfe married Pocahontas, at least in part, because he dreamt that he should beforehand.
But why would the darkness of night, or the length of night when there's no illumination or less, why did that focus people more on their dream lives?
Well, for several reasons. There are far fewer distractions for the senses. Today, even if we wake in the morning from a vivid dream, how many of us remain in bed, especially if we have to get to a job to ponder that vision? One of the more interesting things I discovered in the course of my research is that there was an entirely different pattern of sleep in the pre-industrial age that, among other important conclusions, at least that I thought was significant, was that this gave people far greater access to their visions than we ordinarily have today. Why would that be so? Because people slept in two segments, two phases of sleep, roughly from 9 or 10 o'clock. If they went to bed at that hour, as most did, they would then awaken shortly past midnight, remain awake for up to an hour or even more, and then experienced their second sleep.
And this was considered ordinary, normal? Most people did this? Did they socialize in that waking time, or were they just lying in bed wishing they were back asleep?
Everything imaginable. Certainly, large numbers remained in bed if they didn't have to rise to use the chamber pot, and reflected on the visions that they had just awoken from. And indeed, clinical experiments have been done at the National Institute of Mental Health by a very renowned sleep expert named Tom Weir, immersing individuals, the subjects of his experiment, in darkness without the benefit of artificial illumination. After several weeks, their sleep broke into the same pattern of segmented slumber that I have found repeated references to in historical sources. And so too in the sources, so too in his experiments. People ordinarily awakened from REM sleep, which is ordinarily associated with dreams.
And you're saying in that segmented sleep, in that middle of the night sort of calm wakefulness, you saw that, or they saw that path into their own psyches.
They had an avenue to their psyche through their dreams that we have lost today. Any number of sources speak to this. There was one favorite I have in particular, whereby a critic was quite alarmed at the possibility. He wrote in 1706 in a book entitled The New Art of Thriving, or The Way to Get and Keep Money. He warned his readers against pondering their fantasies. What a shame it is, he wrote, to spend half one's lifetime in dreams and slumbers. Leave your bed, therefore, when first sleep hath left you. lest custom render your body sluggish or your mind a cage of unclean thoughts.
And there sounds like the beginning of the lives we live today, but maybe something lost there as well. Roger Ekirch is with us tonight, author of the new book At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Since that night, we've been together, lovers at first sight. In love forever, it turned out so right. For strangers in the night.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the night and what it meant to humanity, how it was lived before electricity and all the lights came on. My guest tonight is Roger Ekirch. He's author of the new book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. You can join us as well. Can we still conjure the essence of pre-Thomas Edison nighttime? In lighting up the night, have we cut off a pathway to our primal selves? And what's your night story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Charles is calling from New York City. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Well, I have a comment, actually, about the night.
Yeah.
I think, personally, this is my personal opinion, that the fear of night before the time of electricity, well, even now, but especially before the time of electricity and light through the use of gas or any other natural resources such as that, I think it mostly has to do with people's imagination and fear of the unknown. I think it's based, like, for instance, that's how superstitions are made in many cultures. Superstitions are based around creatures or things that have to do with the unknown, like sea monsters in ancient Greece.
And Charles, do you think that people are less vulnerable to that kind of fear today because there's so much more light? Is that a gain or a loss?
Well, in some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. Before there were maps of everything and the world had been discovered many numerous times over, I think that the fear of the unknown had posed a great fear to most people in most places because they had no idea it was out there and they really had no idea of many of the physical properties of today's current civilization. But in today's modern world, I think that we still, many cultures, I mean, the United States is, like, for instance, is a first world country. We're pretty confident in our normal daily routines. But in places, especially places that are deeply rooted in their culture and in their religion, and culture, and I guess you could say civilizations that really haven't evolved to this first world status, have still placed much value on the fear of things that their cultures, I guess you could say, do not understand.
There's the kind of pro light bias in a way there. Charles, thanks for your call. Roger Ekirch, how about it? Do you see our forebears who were without light and so read into that darkness what they would? Do you see them as benighted?
You know, psychologists and anthropologists seem to be of two different minds as to when an inherent fear of darkness might have first taken root in the human psyche. Very likely, this was our first necessary evil. Our prehistoric forebears naturally must have feared whether the sun might not even return. Some psychologists, however, are of the opinion that prehistoric peoples, rather than naturally fearing darkness in its own right, may have first feared specific perils arising in the dark.
So rational fears in that case.
Exactly. Predatory animals, for example. And only then, as night grew increasingly synonymous with these dangers, might early populations across a span of many generations have acquired eventually what would become an instinctive terror. There's absolutely no doubt that whatever its exact source, whether this fear originated at the outset or instead over a prolonged period of time, that certainly later cultures, what we would regard as ancient cultures, Mesopotamia, Greece, Rome, stood to inherit a pronounced aversion to darkness. Mm-hmm. Everywhere one looks in the ancient world, demons seemingly filled the night air.
You describe, you remind us, Thomas Edison said, I don't have the quote at hand, but saying something along the lines of, the electrical illumination will just make better people.
Yes.
The suggestion being that more light meant a higher quality of human. Now, you've described for us, on the one hand, how we may be less in touch with ourselves with all that light around. On the other hand, he saw something, self-interestedly, granted, intrinsically positive about light. How do you end up feeling about that?
I think both are vitally important. I think night still is a time of intimacy and privacy, not to the same degree that it was in the early modern age. There is virtually no privacy during the day, especially in urban areas. If you closed your curtains, assuming you even had any during the day, immediately suspicions would be raised among your neighbors. So night, there's no doubt, served this function to a greater degree. But even today, I mean, who does not associate nighttime with darkness, with intimacy, with privacy? I think, as some of your earlier callers mentioned, night can be a time of profound personal autonomy. Just by observing the night sky, there's a terrific quote from the 18th century from an English laborer who, after treading home from an evening's merriment, exclaimed to a friend, "Would I had but as many fat bullocks as there are stars." So it wasn't just philosophers, not just poets, but the immensity of night had broad personal appeal.
Mary Ellen's calling from Clayton, California. Hi, Mary Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm very excited. I can't read the book. I don't read books very often, but I'm usually so busy, but I think it's a wonderful concept, and I just had a little thing I wanted to share.
Yeah.
I kind of fear darkness, and always have. I came from a big family. There was always people around, and I never really liked the darkness, but I tried my very best not to instill my fears on my children. And last year I went to my daughter's fifth grade camp, which was in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and one of the activities we all had to do was to walk through the woods, through the mountains at night, and I was terrified because there are wild animals and it's pitch dark out, but, you know, again, I can't show my fear, but the counselor had all the 12 girls hold onto each other's shoulders, and like a caterpillar, we walked through, but we could not see a thing. But, you know, she would tell us, well, when you hear the sound of leaves, you know you're under a tree, and if it starts getting like a dirt sound, you know, you might be near a cliff or something. You know, nobody fell, and there were, you know, kind of drop-offs and all, and my daughter loved it. And, again, I was petrified of the whole thing, but by the end, you know, your eyes get accustomed to the darkness, and it was very fun.
And there, a taste of nighttime from the very times past that Robert Eckert is talking about. Mary Ellen, thanks for calling. There's that just that tangible, visceral interaction with night when you're out there and it's dark and you've just got to make your way through it. An interaction that was much more common in these centuries, Roger.
Yes, you know, our eyesight is actually pretty good, as your caller. That was a terrific experience that she related. As she mentioned, our eyesight improves markedly in a bit less than an hour. Our sight at night is only tangibly less powerful than that of owls. It's better than that of most animals. So,
And who would know it today with all the lights on?
Well, to be sure. So there are ways to adjust. And if you consider the fact that 300-400 years ago, Many people lived where they were born. They died in the same community where they had been reared. They indeed did have a very strong mental map of their neighborhoods.
Of the neighborhoods, and maybe of their own minds, a map built in that darkness. Roger Ekirch, we're grateful to you for this terrific tour through night. It's a wonderful book, and it really has brought me back to a kind of appreciation of the darkness on the other side of all that light. Thank you so much for writing it. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Roger Ekirch, author of the new book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. Special thanks tonight to WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Our government needs, first of all, to close down Guantanamo and the 24 secret detention facilities run by the United States as soon as it is practicable.
I know of no one in the U.S. government, in the executive branch, that's considering closing Guantanamo.
For the sake of our national security, the United States Congress needs to renew all the provisions of the Patriot Act, and this time, Congress needs to make those provisions permanent.
Justice Brown's opinions are fully within the mainstream of American jurisprudence. It is the liberal activist groups that are purposely misrepresenting Justice Brown's opinions.
It's shocking to me that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle think this woman is in the mainstream. Is it in the mainstream of America to side with a rapist over a 17-year-old girl?
What we're trying to do is to put together a comprehensive plan that deals with aid, that deals with debt, that deals with trade, and peacekeeping and peace enforcement and conflict resolution, the main killer diseases, but also governance and action against corruption.
The most recent data support the view that the soft readings on the economy observed in the early spring were not presaging a more serious slowdown in the pace of activity.
I am quite surprised that with all my work, and some of it is very, very good, that I'm not remembered for that, you know, that nobody talks about the miracle worker. We're talking about Mrs. Robinson.
And there's a week, former President Jimmy Carter calls for the closure of the American prison at Guantanamo Bay. Donald Rumsfeld says no closure plan is in the works. President Bush urges Congress to renew the provisions of the Patriot Act, all of them. Controversial Judge Janice Rogers Brown is confirmed to the D.C. Court of Appeals. The U.S. and Britain hammer out an agreement on debt relief for poor nations, but this week's visit by Tony Blair fails to resolve differences between the countries on aid to Africa and global warming. Alan Greenspan says the economy is on reasonably firm footing, and actress Anne Bancroft dies at age 73. Jack Beatty, there's a week.
There's a week, and I think some very good news for poor people in Africa. President Bush, Tony Blair was here, people were saying he didn't get anything out of President Bush. Well, he got something quite considerable. Mr. Bush has agreed to change U.S. policy and now to lead with Blair an effort by the G8 to have essentially debt forgiveness for a host of some of the poorest countries on earth. And, of course, they've been strangled trying to pay off this debt that they accrued during in the past. And it amounts to $15 billion. It ain't peanuts. And that money that they're spending to retire their debt could go into, you know, all sorts of infrastructure projects, health projects. And as a matter of fact, to show the level of presidential interest, Karl Rove has sent one of his deputies over to Africa to look at worthy projects that might be funded. A substantial change, and I think a very important one.
But interesting to see how that will work out at the G8. Germany, France, and others not so excited about this debt relief. And still that chorus out there that says, look, if all that money was spent and didn't breed development in the decades that was spent and lost. What's going to make it happen this time around?
Well, that's true. I mean, the other side of that is the development fund, and Mr. Bush has not increased U.S. funding there. But this would free up money if it went through that would, in effect, act like a development fund for these countries. And of course, the administration is making it contingent on reforms in governance, and they say there's been some change there in these countries. And anyway, it's a potentially hopeful development.
Speaking of big money, the cigarette case that's before the courts now. Amazing development this week, Jack, where the people thought the government was going to seek $130 billion, and the Justice Department said, no, $10 billion will do just fine, thank you, after those decades of kind of misleading guys, to say the least, from tobacco companies about the dangers of cigarettes.
Yes, and this was, of course, to was a civil racketeering case, and the money was to go to pay for anti-smoking campaigns, which essentially mean preventing a new generation of smokers. And, you know, of the defendants in this case, they have contributed since 1989 $30 million to politics, 75% of it to the GOP. Now, that sounds bad, but then, and it certainly would lead you to believe there may be a connection. On the other hand, it's peanuts next to what trial lawyers and law firms have contributed, most of it, to the Democrats since 89, a whopping $654 million.
There's a lot of money moving out there. Speaking of politics, Howard Dean back in the news this week, and back leading with that kind of famous Dean tongue.
Yes, I just can't understand it. You know, on this program, certainly I talk often about polarization and some comments that religious right leaders make about gay people and so on. This is his comment about Republicans. You can tell them by looking at them and so on. That's just as offensive. I think Mr. Dean needs to go back to Vermont and let the Democrats find their future without him. We can't have that kind of language in American politics. I mean, when he says they're a white man's party, you know, the last two secretaries of state have been black Americans. President Bush just appointed a black appeals court judge. You know, and then this idea, I can see them when I look at them. I mean, can you see them when you look at the 68% of white high school graduate males who voted for Mr. Bush? That's not the caricature of the Republican. This kind of talk, there's no place for it in American politics.
But what do you think? Howard Dean is no fool, and yet, you know, he seems to have a kind of appetite for that really tough pop to the chops that he just can't resist.
I mean, he takes what could be a sophisticated statement about, you know, the roots of the party and the traditions of the party. So, and he makes it into this just flaming, offensive comment that I think, you know, I can tell him by look. Does he mean his own father? And by the way, it makes you think, is he somewhat driven by resentment of his father, who was a big Wall Street lawyer and substantial Republican? Anyway, I don't mean to psychoanalyze him, but boy, that was just a beaut.
Well, it really got the waves chopping there. Jack, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Listeners, a great weekend to you as well. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.